In the courtroom at Jerusalem, the stage is set for the 115th session of the trial of Adolf Eichmann. Prosecution and defense awaiting the announcement of the verdict. Now in a 300-page judgment, Eichmann is found guilty of crimes against the Jewish people, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. The verdict made Eichmann liable to become the first man to be executed under a civil court verdict in the state of Israel. Eichmann to die on the gallows.
In 1960, when I heard that Adolf Eichmann had been captured in Argentina, it had already been 2 years since I quit my job as police investigator. Although I liked the job, I couldn't support my family with it. But when Eichmann was brought to Israel for trial, I volunteered to work as part of the investigative unit. I told him I had experience in police work and knowledge of European languages. But to the head officer, I admitted that it was mostly an emotional need. The police weren't taking volunteers, but the head officer suggested that I rejoin the force. Receiving a rank higher than I had had before, I began work in Bureau 06, which was in charge of Eichmann's case. When I saw Eichmann for the first time, he looked miserable to me. He wasn't wearing a belt, and his shoelaces and his false teeth had been removed. But when he opened his mouth, I felt as if I were standing at the open gates to the crematorium.
Adolf Eichmann was executed the last day of May in 1962. The same night, after the cremation of the body, a group of police officers guarded his ashes as far as the ocean of Jaffa, and they did disperse them onto the sea. The mission was highly secret. Danny Gall talks about it with Angelica Stapkin, director of Villa Romana in Florence.
I remembered from the previous work that I know from you that very often you start with a document, either an image or a sound document or something that you find and then do a research. And what was the starting point here? Was this a text?
This fact about the Eichmann's ashes were scattered outside territorial waters of Israel is something that people know. In Israel, people know about it, but no one really knows exactly more what happened there. And I was always curious about this fact. How did it happen? This was kind of a very strange event that happened at night, in nighttime. So I tried to read more about it, and I came across the name of Michael Goldman, who is actually the main character in the film. And over a year ago, I managed to get an interview with him. So you're asking about the document. This is somehow the document that, in a way, I produced. I managed to meet him, and he's about 85 today, and to interview him about what happened. And it was very interesting because it wasn't only about this night. I mean, he's a Holocaust survivor who came to Israel at 49, but he was in Auschwitz when he was 17, and then he became a police officer, and then he quit his job. So he told me his story, and somehow at the end we got to this night where he had to do this action and also be witness to the execution itself. And mostly I tried to understand what was the atmosphere of this night. There's no documentation of what happened there. I mean, there were journalists in the executions that wrote about it, but in this whole action, what you see in the film itself, it's not documented. So this was interesting for me to understand, to follow exactly what happened there, how did they do it, but more than that, what was the atmosphere, how did they feel?
I don't know if it's the first time, but that you reenacted, in a way, a historical scene. You asked actors, you made a film, and there were no other images about it before.
Yes, it's a reenactment, but it's definitely not a documentary. So it is based on this information that I managed to collect about this night, and then reenacted it with actors, and tried to kind of like create this event again in a cinematic way.
But in this period or this travel from the crematorium to the boat, there are only very few dramatic moments. There was one in the very beginning when they open the fire and they look at it. I remember that towards the end, this main person is even saying, "I had no feelings about it. I just did what had to be done."
Yeah, what I tried to do is also because there are no dialogues. This was also the main work with the actors, is that to understand how the people who did it felt at the time. Because most of the night is nothing to do. They're sitting in a car, then they're sitting in a boat, and they're waiting. And this, in a way, was the difficult part. I mean, to act, but also, as to my understanding, to the original event, to be in it, because you're in this, in a way, very difficult position where you have to take ashes of this very loaded, this Nazi criminal, and to take it outside the territorial waters, which is a very abstract line, and also this whole idea of using crematorium, which doesn't exist really in Israel, and it has all these associations back to the Holocaust, and so try to understand how did it feel to do that, and which was really an interesting to work with the actors about how to bring out these feelings by sitting there not doing anything.
Time period is on one side, as you said, loaded because it still is the ashes of Eichmann and there is all this memory behind. On the other side, it's this period of 21 minutes where it also becomes very, on one side, abstract and banal. It's only ashes. And why do ashes need four guards? And it's a very, on this side, it's loaded again as if there were still criminal followed. But it's only a kind of milk can or...
This is something that I understood by talking to Goldman and also reading newspaper from the time, that this event was heavily guarded and was very secret and it had to be done fast. So there was this huge phobia in Israel back then from some kind of like intervention. Even I think it's almost fantasy from some kind of intervention of neo-Nazis that will attack them, or also people who would like to revenge Eichmann, the same reason that during the trial they built a glass case to protect him. So there was this huge fear about this thing. And then at the end, Goldman told me that it was like, it wasn't like in the movies, his voice or his reenacted voice tells it, it was a night of horror that I will never forget. And I asked him, what did you feel? What did you talk? He said, we didn't really talk much. We felt that it's a very, historical moment. So I tried to, bring back this moment where you have only some milk can full of ashes, but you still feel the present. It's in a way even scarier than to have a prisoner. It's more like a ghostly thing. Mm-hmm. In a way, that this can of milk, which is also a strange fact that they took a can of milk to use it.
And all these metaphors.
Yeah. I mean, he told me that they used that, so it's not just this kind of filmic thing that is extra, it's really what happened there. And so it becomes very loaded with Celan, and it becomes also like a character in the film. And it was very interesting when we worked on the sound in post-production. The sound designer put a lot of the squeaking sound of the... on the handle of the can, like you have this squeak. And he said that he wanted to give this characteristic to the can, like the sound characteristic beyond the image. So it was interesting to make it a living character in the film.
Yeah, But that was another question also in relation to your previous work, that the sound is very strong in this film. I mean, what is happening in the image is a silent process of four persons, but the drama of the sound is stronger than the drama of the image. Also, the voiceover is not some man's voice, but it sounds like a professional Hollywood male speaker. And usually you work very consciously about this relation between sound and image. Why did you do it this way?
Well, there's two parts. There's a part of the voice and then there's a part of the sounds, the noises. So in a way, the film doesn't have... There are no dialogues. And it's all about this very physical interaction of those people. They look at each other. You can see them whispering some things, but you cannot hear it. And there's this scene at the beginning where the police officer, Goldman, is sitting in front of a priest. And the idea is that they're not speaking the same language and they're trying to interact. And then there's this strange trick, this action. And what happened in the post-production, we actually created the whole sound. It's all external. It's not. It's using a Foley artist who's doing all the movement and all the sounds of the people and then sound effects. And then it's completely artificial. That's why it's extremely detailed. And the effect that it gave is that the heaviness of the silence between the people became more present. And this is something that happened later and I realized it and I really liked it because I'm trying to achieve this effect in the film where, you know, people sit in the same room or like strangers stand in an elevator and there's always this embarrassment of people not talking to each other. And I try to transfer this feeling to the audience that you sit and you watch the film and you also feel this embarrassment, this heavy feeling that is like that usually people are starting to talk even if it's like about nothing, just to break the silence. And I think the sound effects are giving this absence, the absence of speech. Yeah, and then there's the voice, which is very, in a way, external to the film. I chose this very strong, low voice because there's a very something very cinematic character to it.
After Eichmann was hanged, the body was carried to a furnace that was built especially for this occasion. From what I heard, by a 13-year-old kid who had to support himself by working in a large oven factory after school, and was told he was building a furnace for the cremation of fish bones.
Why you translated the text into English? I mean, it could be the original Israel text, but with subtitles, but you translated it already.
Well, subtitles is very problematic in visually, I think. And I also, I might show this film, I mean, if I show it in other countries. I mean, this is a very international context, so English is always like the language that is kind of comfortable. But if I show it in a more local context, I might give a voice of a local, like a local language. I think it could be a good idea for this film. Another idea that I had, which I couldn't apply to the Biennale because of the amount of people there, is to create a situation where the viewer has headphones and can choose between, say, four languages, which also might imitate the situation where Eichmann was doing the trial, had a live interpretation to German from Hebrew or from some people spoke English, but there was this, I mean, you have it in a lot of international court, so the viewer can sit with headphones and choose his own language. It could be something that I'll do later with the film.
The mission was kept very secret. We couldn't even tell our families about it at the time. That was the way we were taught, that a secret could only be kept between two people if one of them was dead.
I was wondering about the last sentence when the voice is telling about that a secret between two people can only survive when one is dead, because it gives this kind of crime film setting again, but on the other side it's the voice of the survivor. Was it a real quotation from God?
Yeah, he definitely told me that. He said, he talked as a police officer. He said, this is the way we were taught, that a secret can be kept only between two people if one of them is dead. And I thought it's very strong, especially in this context where this mission was very secretive. They didn't tell it to the families at the time. No one knew about it. But actually, like, they're taking a dead person, and ashes of a person. And I decided to put it at the end because it's just before you see the two fishermen passing, two Arab fishermen passing by them and looking at them. You know, it's like a secret action has this maybe dimension of crime. We do something that it's a secret now and no one should know about it. And then I created a scene where there's an interaction between those police officers and two fishermen who are just passing by there early in the morning, and they're looking at each other in suspicion. You know, like, what are you doing here and what are you doing here? It's like, what is the police doing here? And on the other hand, the police is looking like you shouldn't, you know, it's this kind of suspicion. It was interesting that my film was almost finished when it happened, when Bin Laden was killed. And it is very interesting that the Americans did this very similar action for some very similar reasons. That they didn't want that the Muslim world would have a shaheed, or parts of the Muslim world will use it as some kind of a memorial, and it's very similar. So it was very interesting that it happened. But also the two cases are similar in the way that it's like a country that decides to, it has the right to do justice without asking anyone else. In Ashman's case, it was trial, and the Americans didn't. They just killed Bin Laden. But there's this parallel in this idea of you know, a nation that decides that it has the right to do justice in its own way without asking international law or without asking opinions. This feeling of, like, they have the right to, which was very strong in Ashman's case, and it was very strong with Bin Laden case, the way you saw the way that they handled it and their reactions.
This interview was recorded by Radio Papesse at the 54th Venice International Art Biennial.
What about the location? Tell me, you don't really expect that people will pass from one country to another like they move between two apartments?
RadioPapesse.org